I'm Aaron Williamson. I'm 50 years old. I was born in Derby in England, and I live and work in London now. Right back to when I was very young, when I was 16 years old, I was a semi-musician, and I always thought that the idea that I was working with was not the content of the music, but the performance of it. And it was punk allowed people to make that radical breach to concentrate on how the music was presented and put in front of people. And we paid very scant attention to the actual content of the music. And so, consequently, discovering performance art has been a process of recognition. Tear up whole piles of scraps of paper, just sit in the middle of the room, tearing up paper for hours on end. And people assumed that I was trying to make some sort of a statement. And I knew nothing about performance art when I do those kind of things. Yeah, it was a similar process when I started writing poetry and was invited to present it to the public. I did start off, like most poets do, with my book in hand and trying to read off of the page. But very often I wouldn't find that a challenging enough exercise, and I couldn't hear my own voice anyway. And so consequently, after doing this a couple of times, I just started either bawling the words out or shaping them, distorting them, and eventually over a process of around 10 years, I went out doing poetry without, reading poetry without an actual words or poetry. Well, I was subjected to many, many hours of watching other poets read their work, and I could only ever speculate on what they were saying, what the words were. Well, I'm deaf. Yeah, sorry about that.
I'm only saying that because you said you couldn't hear your own words, and we don't know why you couldn't hear your own words.
It was more that I couldn't hear my own voice. I memorised, or in fact I composed a lot of my poetry in my memory before I wrote it down. I had a very formalised approach to composition. And so there was a long series of poems that I wrote called Cacophonies, which I would compose inside my head before I write it down eventually. So consequently, those were the poems that I took to performance situations, and they described a radical distortion, destruction, language falling apart. It described all of that. And so I felt rather, when I would be in poetry situations, I would feel as missing the point of the poem itself to represent it verbally. So I decided to represent it through the performance method. Since being very active in poetry, and I do still write privately, I just don't publish, I use writing very specifically as a part of the process of performance. Most of my documentation operates in terms of writing. It's like a creative postscript to the performance. Sometimes I write before the performance and try to imagine the way that it's going to go. But this is not a script, it's more of a speculation. For example, a piece that I did at Mayo, Modern Art Oxford, I wrote a text for that piece that even included the audience's response to it and posted it on the wall. And people came in and read about what the premise of the performance was and how I imagined they would react to it, and then were put in the position of whether they were going to react in that way or not. So writing is something that is really at the heart of what I do still, even though there's no verbal element to the performance. Well, I've definitely moved away from expression in action, and I've become much more involved with an idea of text-based performance, which is to set up something that needs doing or carrying out within a certain situation. And so So consequently, the action is something that's more recognisable now than it was in my earlier work. It's it can be quite vernacular, but it's displaced from the arena that you would normally see it in.
Is this the way you conceive all your works?
It's very process-based. Very often head out to find out what I'm confronted by. And I reconciled myself to the idea of artistic failure quite a few years ago. I made a series of performances called Artistic Failure. And the way that I conceived those works was to go and put myself in a situation that I'd have to respond to with no obligation to think of it in terms of a successful outcome. And so the concept of the work is integrated in, it's a creative response to situations that I find. And the work that I like to do best starts with the most minimal premise. I'm returning to the modern Oxford piece because the action in there was the last thing I discovered. That piece began when from the moment when I used to work for Arts Council panels, and one of the clauses in an artistic contract would be, this is going back to the late 80s, early 90s, you would always have a clause inserted that the artist reserves the right to creatively fail at the endeavour that they're going to set out to do. And this was very, very liberating clause for an artist to work on. They could go away and research something, attempt to put something together. At the end of it, they'd go back to the Arts Council, having spent all this money, and say, I'm really sorry, but I failed. And those were the glory days of performance, all right. Anyway, so I picked up on that premise that you could actually have an artistic failure, and I was on a series of performance art tour in Japan with Seiji Shimoda for Nippath. And what I did was I approached several different forms. Okay, right. Yeah. I approached different forms of art and tried to fail in each one of them. So in sculpture, for example, I was dressed as a dinosaur trying to carve a human foot. And halfway through carving this human foot, I was my chisel was slipping all over the place, and it was really rubbish carving. And I just started bawling out, crying in a dinosaur suit. So consequently, the audience really didn't know how to respond to it because the artist just burst out crying. I was just dressed as a dinosaur. I cried for about 20 minutes, I think. That was one piece, and so on and so forth. Just really rubbish versions of different forms of art. My own favourite phrase that I use to myself about performance art, a definition of it, is that it's an act designed to concentrate the will. And my name's Williamson. I've got one heck of a lot of willpower. And I've got a very complicated relationship to willpower. I'm interested in people who use willpower have to operate at the periphery of consciousness about a situation. The more they know about it, the more aware they are of what's going on, then the more stronger the willpower that they can use. And I really think that's quite central to what I do. I'm ready to relinquish control over a situation because that's quite an amateur idea of willpower. The person who really uses their will over a situation is ready to absorb and react to things. I think performance art really is a theory of selfhood. It's how do you think about yourself, how do you place yourself, how do you design the way that you react to things, and how do you think people see you, and how much have you got control or interest over that? Obviously, most people live a vernacular mode of life where they don't, they have to perform their everyday activities, their ablutions or whatever it is, without having to think too much about it. And I think performance is the diametric opposite of that, where you become, where you put anything under an objective microscope. It's a discipline, which is to do with blowing things up, of looking at things, small things, and blowing them up into a large way, and then placing them in front of either a public or an audience, in order for them to decide for themselves what's at stake when these things occur, or take place. Yeah, I think an audience is something that you design. An audience may not know it's an audience. I mean, you walk into a supermarket and start clapping for no particular reason, and all of a sudden you've got an audience. personally, I prefer an audience that doesn't know it's my audience. Very much try to avoid going to situations where people have paid a ticket and have a set of expectations about what I do, because I've never resorted to virtuosity or anything like that. If you use that expanded definition of an audience, then I think I'd have to answer that no, because I think that an audience may not know it is an audience, but you have to address it somewhere, it has to go somewhere. I was always taken with Ellen Cizou's idea that the writer must invent the reader. She was opposed to the solipsism of just thinking that a tree falls in a forest on its own, that sort of idea. So I do subscribe to the idea that a performance does need an audience, even if it's an unknowing one or a posterior audience or something that you communicate later on. It wouldn't really be a performance without that. Yeah. Well, in those situations, the camera is the audience, or at least it's a gateway, a channel out to an audience. So I started feeling, exploring and celebrating the importance that you share. And with the 15mm gang, for example, it's just something that they are individuals that very much amuse me, you know, I identify with, because I've always similarly shared that sense of importance. I mean, I'm not so much bothered about the political claims of disability, although they are very important. It's definitely more this gang mentality that I like. Oh, I hope so, yeah, very much. I mean, The Freaks is one of Todd Browning's film, Freaks, is the document that divides the disability community. And I work with people who have it right up there on the pedestal as one of the greatest works of the 20th century. However, I do think that it's a freak show in reverse in some respects, because a lot of the freakishness we draw out is not necessarily our own, but the responses to us in certain situations. Catherine Araniello and I, as a disabled avant-garde, for example, follow Swift's satirical method of making an outrageous proposition and placing it in front of the public and drawing out a freakish response to it. I'm assuming you know Swift's proposal that to solve the vast hunger in Ireland, that people should learn to procreate and eat their babies to keep themselves alive. And what he was doing there was to find out who would take that proposition seriously and react to it. And there were several MPs of his day who read his pamphlet, The Modest Proposal, and thought it was just a really spiffing idea and would solve a lot of problems for the English people. And so consequently, the DAG, the Disabled Avant-Garde, we follow that premise. So it's a freak show, yeah, but perhaps we aren't the freaks. Disabled Avant-Garde. In Australia, a DAG is like a larrikin. The works I've done with 15mm and with DAG, we had a retrospective at Spark Island last year, and I was asked precisely this question: how did I define my role in terms of everyone's contribution to those collaborations? And the title we came up with was A Bell Clapper and Bestiary. I'm placed in a situation where I stand in the street and clang a bell and see who congregates, come towards me, my bestiary, to work with me. So it's very much collaborative. I'm only someone who whistles us together. It's very much like your role with the wolf in the winter. I had a retrospective for all of my collaborative work at Spark Island last year, and in Bristol. And I was asked to define how I see myself in relation to the other artists that I collaborate with in 15mm films and with Catherine as the disabled avant-garde. And having thought about it for some time, and this question arose about whether I was a director or a performer in relation to these other artists, but the way I thought about it was that I described the title of the show became The Bell Clapper and Bestiary. And my idea, the image of myself, is someone who rings a bell for a congregation to arrive, like a church. And so consequently, I'm in these abstract situations where I'm given the opportunity to work with fellow travellers, people I identify with, people who excite me or interest me. And so I'm in a situation where I can tinkle this bell and ask people to come and join me. Bedlam. When I talked to you earlier about using willpower over situations, I actually think I have a talent for collaboration. It's something I very much enjoy because it's so much the opposite of how I work in my solo work. I very much have to stand back and allow the thing to take on its own life and the individual to bring their own momentum to an idea. I'm actually very good as someone who can lead things in that sort of situation, but I'm probably not quite as good at being as someone who follows the situation. So, I take humour very seriously indeed. In the book that I wrote that was published about my work, a documentation, I traced my development as a performance artist and was quite amazed, astounded, to realise how earnest and serious my first attempts at performance art were compared to how gallivanting and antic they've become. And what I thought about that, the moment of realisation, was for me a philosophical idea that seriousness, earnestness, the straightforward intent of the work, is always bounded by folly, and that no matter how much you apply yourself to creating an earnest interpretation or representation of a situation, you always find something funny or humorous about it at the end of it. I really wanted to come and describe what happened with Cabaret Melancholique when we started that in the early 2000s, but I hadn't made any humorous work at that point. And I was very excited to read Brian describe a piece that he did in Japan, where he was in some kind of arcade shopping centre. And I'm not sure if I'm right, but I think you ended the text on saying it was the first time you'd ended up in the jaws or the arms of humour, and that you created a really pathos element where some kind of doll, I mean, I wasn't there, so I only read about it. But I had that similar moment of realisation when Cabaret Melancholique started, and it was like I was very influenced by an Irish band called the Bogmen, who were from my dad's hometown. And I don't want to ramble on too much, but they were fantastic, virtuoso ceilidh musicians who, for the crack, played very, very, very badly indeed. And formed a band with a couple of the guys from the Pogues that were meant to be a version of the Bogmen, in the sense that they were just the worst music you could hear. And it was hilarious and it was great fun. But what happened was I caught up with Brian later that year. We were in Harley doing The Wolf in the Winter. No, not Harley, it was Den Bosch. And I said to Brian that in the meantime, between Cabaret Melancholique and this performance I did in Den Bosch, where I was wearing a shadow suit and trying to stand in Cats of Light, to stand in shadows that split me in half, that I hadn't been able to get back from the humorous momentum of Cabaret Melancholique, that I had gone off to do my earnest pieces that were illustrating ideas about language and reception, acousticity, but I'd always at the last moment turned them into a humorous event. You can use the idea of expectation as a palette. You can, performance is very good at using very many things, a whole spectrum of responses from boredom to hatred to everything other than just a round of applause at the end of it. And that's great. It's a very fluid medium to work in, where you can go into a situation and deliberately construe to twist the expectation that people will have of it. 2 weeks ago, I gave a collecting lecture at the Tate Britain, and it was a very formally arranged lecture with a bogus description of what I was going to talk about. It was titled Language as a Metalanguage. And a lot of academics got wind of it, and so consequently the place was packed out with the great and good of the art world. And it was part of Late at the Tate. So consequently I arrived 15 minutes late, and the person that was introducing me had spent all that time going into the finer points of my CV, trying to keep the audience waiting for me to arrive. And the lecture proceeded to do the lecture where everything was set up to collapse. I had worked with the technicians for 2 days beforehand, and we worked very investigated all the different things that could go wrong during this lecture. And the audience weren't in on this ruse. So their expectation was that they would come away with some very abstruse philosophical ruminations on the idea of language as a pissy meta language, which they don't even know what it means. And so consequently, everything went wrong. And we staged arguments and falling out. People got up to try and help me. Some very prominent people in the art world left after 10 minutes. And the technicians took a lot of abuse from people at the back of the room. And I just stood there as kind of this indexical figure where this whirlwind whipped around me. And it was actually a fantastic importation of knowledge, if you like. But it was the expectation was that it would be realised in a completely different way to the way that I did it. Yeah, it was risky, yeah. Funny enough, the collapsing lecture is based on a nightmare that I had, which was very much like the classic examination room nightmare, where you know everything that you need to write down to pass this examination, but for some reason you lose the wherewithal to put it down on paper. And so the collapsing lecture began for me going around meeting other people and asking them what were their very worst experiences in a lecturing situation were, and collected all these incredible anecdotes and then decided to draw upon them for my own work. I don't think that's a risk so much, really. It's definitely a calculated risk. Yeah, I wrote a PhD and it was definitely the kind of thing you'd only want to do once. I've got an answer to that as well. Performance is very good at disrupting people's expectations of what is going to happen. Some of the greatest performances I've ever seen have not done what they're supposed to do. The only example I could think about to give you a weird with surprise and expectation is that sometimes I'll do a performance which is just a classic piece of clowning, but it's displaced from where you would expect it to occur. In the collapsing lecture, going back to that, I had a really, really expensive, the Tate Britain screen, right, which must have cost about £20,000. And I had this marker pen in my hand, and I said to the technicians, I got this board, they've got no rubber, so I wrote some words on the board, and when that was full up, I said, oh, is it all right if I just write on the back here, right? Using a lot of very obvious suspense, I got the marker pen on it, and I was going to be describing the history of aspect ratios in video art. While I was going on about aspect ratios, talking about this shift from 16:9 to 14:9, I'd got this marker pen that was sellotaped over the nib of it. Yeah, but everybody was waiting for me to stop talking about aspect ratios and slice it down through the middle of this £20,000 cinema screen. So when I did do that, I just looked at it and said, oh, shit, it's got no ink in it. So, but my point is that the expectation is, if that was a clowning piece, then that's the kind of thing you would expect. But what performance is very good at is taking this displacement of expectation and doing something, put it in an arena where you wouldn't expect that thing to occur. And so in that, the curator, Marianne Mulvey, had seen me do the collapsing lecture at Goldsmith College. And I've been around with it, I've been on tour with it, if you like. I've done it about four or five different art colleges. So I don't think, interestingly enough, I probably would have never made it onto that podium to talk about my own work. I was invited specifically to go there and do a lecture that collapsed in on itself. I've never been afraid of risk because it's something that I've always found very easy to do. Going back to being a punk rocker, there was absolutely no consequence to writing deliverable tunes and trying to entertain people's expectations. It was all, risk was the game itself. It wasn't something that you added on to what you were doing. It was, the whole thing was risk. And so I feel, if anything, it's a contradiction, it's that I feel at home with risk. I've answered that question with the Autistic Failure series that I did, but in all seriousness, my greatest success is that when I left school, my options as a young deaf man were taken away from me. I went to a careers advisor and I was the two things on the table was an apprenticeship at Rolls-Royce Aeroplane Engines or an apprenticeship at the British Railway. And I tried to fluff my way through these interviews and they sort of caught me out and they said, oh, you're deaf. So I couldn't get myself an apprenticeship at either British Rail or Rolls-Royce. So my greatest success is that I've actually done anything with my life after that initial failure.